Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome to this wonderful event, the inaugural lecture for Professor Anna Mattani. I'm Alex Voorhoover, the head of department, and it's my great pleasure to offer some introductory comments to celebrate our colleague Anna Mattani. I know she's in fear of being praised in public, but I hope you will forgive me, Anna, for doing a little bit of that, because as I recently went to a different inaugural lecture at UCL, and the impressive professor and head of department who gave the introduction there said, as much as I'm now going to praise my colleague, it's not really about her. Instead, what these moments are about is a celebration of our common standards for excellence in our field as educators, as colleagues, and as scholars. And a moment in which we can all reaffirm our commitment to those values, which I'll try to argue Anna embodies to the highest degree, and be happy that there is someone out there who meets the standards that we like to set for ourselves and for our community. In other words, it's a communal celebration. Of course, it's also a celebration of an individual achievement and at least a temporary culmination of a very long period of hard work and study, and also work as an educator. And for Anna, this work began in Leeds, where she did her undergraduate in philosophy before she moved on to Oxford to do the BPhil, and then her PhD at Sheffield, which she received in 2005. This was followed by many years as an educator, but primarily as a researcher on a British Academy postdoctoral research fellowship in Oxford, until finally she made the best decision of her life and joined our department in 2013. First as an LSE fellow, but we soon realized that we would love to have her as a permanent colleague, and so she became an assistant professor in 2014, just a year later, 4 years later, associate professor, and from the beginning of this academic year, professor in our department. And this journey, especially her rapid rise at LSE, are the fruits of many qualities, each of which kind of embodies what we hope for in a community of scholars. The first of these, of course, is research. And I will speak more, and Anna will speak more about the content, the wonderful content of her ideas, but I did, when glancing most recently at her list, realize that she's published well over 10 articles in the top 5 journals in philosophy, none of which I've published in, for example, so she sets the standard a lot higher than I have for myself. And it's not just, of course, where she places them, but also the core of the ideas and her approach which stands out. The hallmark of Anna's work, which you will also find if you're sitting in a lecture or listening, as I have with great pleasure, to many of her talks, is extremely careful preparation of the ground. The basic concepts and ideas of any field in which she works, and she works in epistemology, or the theory of knowledge, the philosophy of language, and partly due to the good environment she's in at LSE, has been moving into decision theory and questions in welfare economics, which she'll be looking at today. What Anna does is she takes the basic concepts, the basic principles that everyone takes for granted in the field, studies them carefully, tries to find a way to express them in their simplest terms, and almost always finds a problem that previously no one had noticed. And then comes the pursuit of the problem, the explanation of why this really is a problem that may even threaten some core ideas. Now, Anna was already early in her career well recognized among a select group of experts in the field for these qualities. And I recall when we announced the news that Anna was joining us as assistant professor, receiving an email from a friend saying, "Oh, you have such excellent taste in philosophy." And I congratulated myself and I said, "But, you know, why?" And this friend said, "Because, you know, the way Anna eviscerated that paper by this leading philosopher, you know, beautiful work, dead on the floor right afterwards." And I thought, wow, you know, I hadn't realized that this gentle soul was capable of such evisceration. And then I read the piece and I realized, yes, the view is probably dead now, but it was put in the nicest possible terms. And then after this, congratulating myself and passing this congratulations on to our colleagues that we had excellent taste in philosophy, a creeping feeling of dread came over me. What if I would be the next recipient of this treatment? And indeed, unfortunately, this is what happened. So, at the heart of my work and of many other theorists in distributive justice is the idea that we should track, as one of the things that matter for distributive justice, a person's prospects, how well a person is going to do. Just to give you the flavor of this core, how important this idea is, suppose first that I have some novel treatment. It may work, it may not work. And it's a 50-50 gamble, let's say, and you will be the recipient of this novel treatment. The upside is yours if it works, the downside is yours if it works, and you might abstain from it. I might provide it to you on the grounds that the upside is worth the downside for you, and you might take it on those grounds. Now, imagine the very same situation, two people in the very same situation you're in, except if I give you both the treatment, the upside is for you, but the downside, I'm afraid, goes to you. This switch in who the recipient is of the downside of a prospect, rather the person themselves or the same person who could get the upside or a different person, seems to matter tremendously in distributive justice. And indeed, it's the linchpin of almost all my work in the last 10 years in the theories of distributive justice, that this difference has to be thought through to the very end. Unfortunately, Anna's work, some of which she will present this evening, throws this core idea into doubt, from which I have not yet recovered, I'm afraid, and many others in the field have not recovered either. And if she's right in the story that she'll tell this evening, then many things that you might also hold dear, like the idea that when we have only one kidney to offer two people who need a kidney transplant, we should flip a fair coin. Again, focusing on the equal distribution of prospects, may be threatened by her work. So, exciting and devastating stuff as a thinker. But just a bit on two other elements of Anna as an academic. One is, as an educator, she really is second to none. And her devotion to education has not merely been to her own students, but also to widening participation in philosophy. And I noticed something I'd forgotten, Anna, when I looked over your CV, was that one of your first jobs was as philosophy tutor in Hackney and Tower Hamlets in summer university. For those of you who don't know Hackney and Tower Hamlets, it's comparatively deprived parts of London, and it speaks to Anna that that was one of her first jobs straight out of a PhD. And she's kept that spirit of widening participation here in the department, spearheaded many of our initiatives, including as EDI, or Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Officer. Anna has been a truly wonderful teacher and introduced two new courses, Epistemology and Philosophy of Language, to great success. And finally, as a colleague, she has been extraordinary. So I've had the great privilege of working with her. She's been Deputy Head of the Department for the last 2.5 years. And academics are not known for their personal qualities, let's face it. Right? Many of us go into the business because we want to work by ourselves without interruption. Thank you very much. My mother's not like this at all. She's wise, caring, calm under pressure, upbeat. She's picked me up on many occasions when I found the job too difficult. And a person of the greatest integrity, where she's constantly devoted to students and to the well-being of colleagues. Please join me in celebrating Professor Anna Mattar.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction, Alex, and thank you all for coming out tonight to this talk. Here's the current department that I want to thank so much for all of your support and all of the philosophical challenges and inspiration. PhD students and other students aren't on this photograph, but I wish they were, because I want to thank them as well for all of their inspirational support. I was thinking back to what the department was like when I first arrived. Here's an early photo from then. It's about just over 10 years ago. Isn't it weird how it already looks historical, doesn't it? Kind of faded in the mists of time. Compare. Look, isn't that weird? It's only 10 years ago. But yeah, it already looks kind of historical. But I remember it very well. There's some people who are still here and some people who've come and gone in between. Now, when I first arrived here, I came in largely as a philosopher of language. And then I got caught up in all the talk in this department about probabilities and decision theory and welfare economics. So I started wanting to work in those areas. But then I started to realize that actually some of the work in philosophy of language could be applied to probabilities and decision theory and welfare economics. So I started bringing in some of those ideas, like vagueness and contextualism. And there's one idea that I got particularly obsessed with, and that's the subject of my book. So yeah, I just wrote this book and it came out this January. So this is kind of a book launch as well as an inaugural lecture. So it's called The Object of Credence. And yeah, I just want to first of all thank Ben for helping me track down the photographer, because I found this photograph on the internet and I thought it was perfect for the book, but we couldn't find the person to ask permission. And eventually Ben tracked them down. It was a non-photographer living in Belfast and we got permission for it. And the reason I wanted this particular photo is because I feel like it sums up the whole topic of the book. So you'll see there's a single object, the cork, but it has two different shadows. And they're both veridical shadows, right? It's just two different angles on the same object. And because the shadows look so different, if you only saw the shadows, you might not know that they were two shadows of the same object. So if we only accessed objects via their shadows, we wouldn't necessarily know that we were looking at the same object twice. And that captures the idea behind this book. So I'll go through it more gradually and show you how it applies to probabilities and decision theory. So to explain the idea, what I wanted was two different ways of accessing the same object. And there's lots of historical examples of this. Frege, the philosopher, uses Hesperus and Phosphorus, which are the names for the stars that the ancient Greeks saw in the sky, one in the evening and one in the morning. But it turned out that they were pointing both times at the same thing, the planet Venus. In the book, I use George Orwell, the author, and his real name, Eric Blair, as two different ways of accessing the same object. But I wanted an example from the department, so I went looking to see if there were any cases like this. Here's one I found. So Alex, as we know, he dressed up as Death or the Grim Reaper to give a talk at the Halloween event. So I thought it was possible, right, that you might know Alex, you might have gone to his lectures. And then some guy turns up, Dr. Death, and you might not realise that they were one and the same. I thought that was maybe a bit obscure. There's also this. So this is from the Halloween party as well. But I don't... This was a bear that I can see in the video, dancing bear. Who is this bear? Do we know? Is it you?
I'm not saying.
Okay, so I can't use this example because I can't identify the bear. So in the end, I decided to go with Campbell. So Campbell Brown is a philosopher in our department. He works in ethics and generally brilliant. He's also a gamer. I don't know if you know that about him. And he didn't want me to use his real gaming name because he doesn't want all the students to start playing him online knowing it's him. But he's given me a fake name that I can use. So we're going to pretend that Campbell Brown is Nerd Slayer 81. And I think Campbell plays more sophisticated or more modern games than this, but we're going to pretend that he spends his time playing chess online as Nerdslayer 81. So now it's possible, right, that a student, peer maybe, could have different beliefs about Campbell from their beliefs about Nerdslayer. So it might be that there's a student peer who goes to Campbell's lectures and believes that Campbell is a philosopher, and then in the evening goes home and plays online chess, plays against Nerdslayer 81, and has no idea that Nerdslayer and Campbell are one and the same. So in that case, peer might believe that Campbell Brown is a philosopher without believing that Nerdslayer 81 is a philosopher. So the thought here is that the objects of belief are not really the things or the people in themselves. Peer's beliefs aren't really about Campbell the person. They're about Campbell under a particular designator or mode of presentation or way of seeing Campbell. So Peer's got one belief about Campbell under the Campbell Brown designator, but a different belief about Campbell under the Nerdslayer 81 designator. So I find this quite a kind of weird, maybe even a bit of a spooky idea, that maybe our beliefs aren't about the objects in themselves, but just about sort of shadows of those objects. So this view about belief isn't uncontroversial, but it's something that everyone working in philosophy of language is familiar with. They can see the pull of this idea. And I think the very same thing applies to credences or probabilities. So in the LSE philosophy department, as I found out after I arrived, people aren't talking that much about outright belief. They're mostly talking about credences or degrees of belief or probabilities. So a credence in a proposition is kind of like how certain you are of it. If you're completely certain of it, you've got a credence of one in it. If you're completely certain it's false, you've got a credence of zero. If you're moderately certain, it will be somewhere between zero and one. So I think that just as we don't have beliefs about things in themselves, the same holds for credences. So it might be that Peer has a credence of 0.9 that Campbell Brown is a philosopher, but only a low credence of 0.2 that Nerdslayer is a philosopher. So this is kind of the central tenet of the book, is that the objects of credence are opaque. And I'm saying that they're opaque because the names in there, like Campbell Brown and Nerdslayer, they're not just transparently pointing you to the object. The name matters in itself. So this is the central tenet of the book. Just to put it formally, what would an LSE philosophy talk be without a little bit of formalism? So if we say that S, a person, has a credence of V, this would be where the number goes, that A is F, where A is an object and F is, say, a property, then how you designate A, what name you give it or what description you give it, matters. The credence might change if you designate A in a different way. Okay, so this is the central tenet of the book, and I argue for it. I think it's more plausible as a thing to say about credences than it is even about beliefs. But you might wonder why it actually matters. Like, what follows from this claim? So, Christian List, those of you who know him, he's next to me in this picture. He's left the department now and gone to Munich. But I can still hear his voice in my head. And what he's saying is, Anna, the probability framework, probability, is just a mathematical object. It's really flexible, and you can interpret it and apply it in all sorts of different ways. We'll be able to find a way of interpreting it where it can accommodate your tenet that the objects of credence are opaque. And I agree with that. I spent the last two chapters of the book trying to find ways of interpreting the credence or probability framework so it leaves room for this idea that the objects of credence are opaque. I mean, I guess it's kind of like as if I was to say, when you measure an object, when I want to know the measurement of an object, if I measure it from one round one area, I get one result, and if I measure it around a different area, I get another result. Doesn't show that maths is broken, right? Or even that there's anything wrong with my tape measure. It just shows that you have to use mathematical tools with care and think about how you interpret them. So I agree with that. And so one job, which I try to do in the book, is to give an interpretation that accommodates the tenet. But there's this other whole big job as well, because we're not at the beginning of using the probability framework. It's already been used a lot by philosophers and economists and statisticians and policymakers. And so it's like it's already kind of grown up. All of these sort of principles and arguments and points are supposed to follow from it. And I think that the consciously or unconsciously, people have been assuming that the objects of credence are transparent. And because of that, some of the growth is actually wrong. So there's some parts that need to be examined and maybe cut away or retrained. And I go through some of these problems in the middle big section of the book. So I'll list some now, and then we're going to zoom into just one of them. So I look at deference principles. These are principles that say you should defer to how you defer to another person or to your future self. So I think, of course, that you don't defer to a person at all. You defer to a person under a designator. So that changes these principles. The principal principle, which unites credences with objective chances, I think whereas the objects of credence are opaque, the objects of chance are not opaque in quite the same way, which creates some problems. Some problems for decision theory, and I talk about this with the example of the two envelope paradox. And finally, some problems in welfare economics. And I'm going to zoom in to talk about these problems here. So with welfare economics, you're thinking about how to distribute some good over a population of people. So you might have different policies you're considering, and you're thinking about what the welfare of each person in your population will be under these different policies. So just to make it simple, I'm going to pick a population of just two people at first, Sam and Kate, my children who are here. Oh, they're teenagers. I don't know if they'll want me to call them children, but yeah. So I decided, because I thought there might or might not be drinks and snacks after the talk, I thought I'd bring some chocolates to contribute. And when I was buying them, I was thinking I could either buy mint chocolates or I could buy orange chocolates. Now, I happen to know that Sam likes mint chocolates more than orange chocolates. So if I buy mint chocolates, Sam's welfare will be high, it'll be 10. If I buy orange, it will be slightly lower, 9. You might wonder where I'm getting these numbers from, right? Assuming I can just measure welfare and give you a number. That's a good challenge, but I'm going to assume for the purpose of this talk that we can do that. Kate, on the other hand, she prefers orange to mint chocolate. So she'll have a welfare of 9 if I buy mint and 10 if I buy orange. So this is a difficult decision problem, right? Because Sam's better off if I buy mint, Kate's better off if I buy orange. Their welfare is pulling me in two different directions. How do I decide? We might need to do some actual difficult ethics here. Not an easy problem. I don't have a favourite child, for example, so it's not an easy problem to solve. But some problems are easy to solve. So here's one that's a bit easier. Let's suppose I've been to the shop. It's neither mint nor orange chocolate. It's just these guys, these chocolates that I got. But I still have a choice because I can either distribute the chocolates between you all or I can just chuck them in the bin. If I hand out the chocolates, then Sam and Kate will both have a welfare of 9 because these are chocolates they like equally much. If I throw them away, they'll both have slightly lower welfare of 5. So here it seems obvious what to do, right? For both of the people, for the whole population, welfare is higher if I hand out chocolates than if I throw them away. So it seems obvious I should do that. It's better for everybody. And here we're relying on the Pareto principle, which just says if each person, well, this is one simplified version of it. If each person has higher welfare under action A than under action B, do action A. Seems like a no-brainer, right? If it's better for everyone, why wouldn't you do it? Okay, so I think this example was a little bit too simplified because I made out that I was quite certain of what welfare they would have under each action. And that's not normally the case. Normally you would be a little bit uncertain. So let's introduce a little bit of uncertainty. So some chocolates that I've had recently, particularly dark chocolates, they have these actual crystals of salt in. I think it's a sophisticated thing for the sophisticated people. But I can tell you that neither Sam nor Kate nor I like those chocolates. So we have to factor in the risk that maybe these chocolates are those ones with salt in. So I think the probability they've got salt in is quite low, it's just 0.1. But Sam and Kate's welfare, if I hand them out and they are salted, will be just 0.3. If they're not salted, then of course they'll have high welfare, and I think that's likely, 0.9 probability that they're not salted. So we can now work out the expected welfare for both Sam and Kate if I hand out the chocolates. So it's going to be, there's a 0.1 chance of 0.3 welfare plus 0.9 chance of 0.9 welfare. So it works out quite high, 0.84. And it's going to be the same for Kate. And throwing them away just has expected welfare of 5. So here we can see that both Sam and Kate's expected welfare is higher if I hand out the chocolates than if I throw them away. So again, it seems like this is an easy decision to make and I should hand out the chocolates. And I think the underlying principle here is the ex ante Pareto principle. So the difference here is it's about expected welfare rather than actual welfare. So the welfare I've calculated taking the risks into account. And this principle says if each person has higher expected welfare under some action A than action B, then you should do A rather than B. So that also seems like a really compelling principle. And it's a principle that, as Alex said, is used a lot in welfare economics. Like people argue over whether or not their account can accommodate this principle because it sounds really intuitive. But I think that this principle is one of the ones that has grown up as a result of the transparency assumption. Assuming the objects of credence are transparent. And it's one of the things that should be cut away or changed. So the reason for that is just that the objects of credence are opaque. So the credence we have about an object or person depends on how it's designated. And when we're calculating the expected welfare for a person, we use our credences. That's part of the calculation, right? Our own probabilities. And so because our credences about a person depend on how they're designated, similarly the person's expected welfare ends up depending on how they're designated. So we can illustrate this with the Campbell example. So we remember Pia, who doesn't know that Campbell Brown is Nerdslayer. Let's suppose now that Pia is Campbell's GTA. She's his graduate teaching assistant. And she's supposed to mark some essays, get them all finished tonight, so that Campbell can moderate them tomorrow. But she's stuck on the computer playing chess against Nerdslayer. So she has two options, right? Either she can carry on playing Nerdslayer, play another game of chess, or she can get off the computer and get her marking done on time. Now, she might think about the expected welfare for Campbell Brown under each of those actions. And she'll think, for Campbell Brown, his expected welfare will be higher if I complete the marking on time. But what about Nerdslayer? The expected welfare for Nerdslayer is higher if I carry on playing chess. If I stop, then maybe Nerdslayer will be bored. So we can see that the expected welfare under these actions for Campbell Brown and Nerdslayer is different, even though they're both exactly the same person. So expected welfare doesn't really attach to people, it attaches to people under designators. So I think this is a problem for the ex ante Pareto principle. This says if each person has higher expected welfare under A than B, then you should do A rather than B. But whether a person has higher expected welfare is going to depend on how they're designated. So first we'd have to decide how the people should be designated. And that, so I think that decision, which is usually just made unconsciously, like nobody thinks about this, is actually turns out to be a massively ethically loaded decision. So to illustrate how this goes wrong, I'm going to use the chocolate example again. Obviously, this is a trivial example, suitable for this kind of evening lecture, but the same thing applies to much more serious situations, like decisions about health policy or transport policy or taxation. Okay, so let's stick for now with the chocolate example. So I've brought some chocolates, as I say, because I thought I'd add them to whatever we're having afterwards, and also as a bribe. And I counted you as you came in, and I think that there is 100 of you, and unfortunately I only have 99 chocolates. So we have a distribution problem here, right? I have to decide how to distribute these chocolates amongst you. 99 chocolates, 100 people, what do you do? So I've come up with two different distribution policies for us to choose between. So the first one is chocolate lottery. So I'm going to assume that if you get a chocolate, you get a welfare of 10. If you don't get a chocolate, you get a welfare of 0. Let's assume this is added welfare, otherwise 0 is a bit depressing, but yeah. So under chocolate lottery, what I did is I've got these cards, and I wrote your names down as you came in, and then I shuffled them and numbered them. So somebody in the room is person 1, somebody is person 2, and so on, all the way down to person 100. So someone in the room is person 100, but I don't know who it is, you don't know who it is, selected it randomly. So if we go for chocolate lottery, here's what we'll do. Person number 1 gets a chocolate from the box, person number 2 gets a chocolate from the box, and so on. Person number 100 doesn't get a chocolate. Okay, that's chocolate lottery. Let's think about the welfare of each person under chocolate lottery. So we'll start with the welfare of Richard. How's Richard's welfare under this policy? So it's 9.9, right? He's got a 0.99 chance of getting a chocolate. That would give him a welfare of 10. So his expected welfare and a chocolate lottery is 9.9. Similarly, Jing Yi's is 9.9. Everyone's welfare under this policy is going to be, everyone's expected welfare is 9.9. So pretty high. Now, the other policy that I came up with that we could do instead is what I'm calling bash and share. So what I'll do, if we go for bash and share, what I'll do is I'll get all of these chocolates and I'll just smooch them all together. And I'll make a big kind of chocolatey lump. And then I will cut it into exactly 100 pieces. So we'll all get a piece of chocolate of the same size. But when I cut it up, I think that I'm kind of making the chocolate a little bit more disgusting. So you, although getting a piece of smudged up chocolate is better than nothing, it's nowhere near as good as getting a whole chocolate. So that will give you a welfare of just 5. So under bash and share, everyone's welfare is exactly 5. Okay, so now it looks like the ex ante Pareto superior option is chocolate lottery, right? That's the one I should go for. Every single person has higher expected welfare under chocolate lottery than under bash and share. So that's what I should go for, right? So this is the Pareto superior option. But the thing is, it only looks like that because I've chosen these designators. If I choose a different set of designators, we get a different result. So here's another set of designators, right? We've got person number one. One of you in this room is person number one, and person number two, and so on. So if I designate everyone like that, then we can check out their expected welfare under each option. So for person number one, well, first of all, for bash and share, it's the same as before. Everyone gets a sure 5 welfare. Under chocolate lottery, person number one is going to get 10, and so is person number two, and so on. So it looks like all these people have higher expected welfare under chocolate lottery than under bash and share, except, of course, for person number 100. Person number 100, their expected welfare is 0, because they're definitely not going to get a chocolate. So person number 100... their expected welfare is actually higher under bash and share than it is under chocolate lottery. So it turns out that chocolate lottery isn't Pareto superior after all. So you can see that whether or not a policy is Pareto superior depends on how we designate our population. And you can imagine the results, the implications this might have for example, health policy. It matters whether we designate people just by their NHS number or by their likelihood to develop a particular disease, for example. Okay, so that's one. So we've had a look at the book in general, and we've dived particularly into one application of it, which is to the ex ante Pareto principle, which I think should either be deleted, like we should stop worrying about this principle and just say it's incoherent, right? If you get different results depending on which designators you use, as it stands, it's just an incoherent principle. Or we can try and repair it by coming up with special designators, or I've got other ideas as well of how it should be repaired, which we can talk about maybe in the Q&A. Okay, so just before we finish, I just want to talk very briefly about more recent work. So, as I say, the book came out in January, and since then, I've been thinking about a related but slightly different topic, which is about dementia and decision making. And there's all sorts of interesting questions in this area. If you know someone with dementia, you'll have encountered the problems with decision making for or on behalf of someone who has dementia. And one important question is whether we should focus on what the person currently seems to want or whether we should focus on what they would have wanted before the dementia took hold. What would they have wanted for this stage of their lives? But this topic also does connect up with the idea of the objects of belief and credence and indeed desire being opaque. I can see it particularly clearly, actually, in cases of dementia. And I think that's because sometimes there's so much missing information that it comes out particularly strongly. So it might be that someone with dementia wants to see their nephew. And then when you present them with their nephew, you know, the middle-aged man that is now their nephew, they don't want to see that guy, right? They wanted to see the nephew under a particular mode of presentation and don't even recognize the nephew under the other mode of presentation. So it seems really clear in cases of dementia that people aren't desiring objects in themselves because you can supply the object. Rather, they're desiring objects under particular designators. And one of the sad and difficult things about these cases is that sometimes the mode of presentation, the way of accessing the object, is no longer available. Maybe they wanted the nephew under the mode of presentation of him as a child, and that mode of presentation just isn't available anymore. So it actually does connect up with my work on credences having and beliefs having opaque objects. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you as well, the whole department, for everything else.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you, Anna. So, everyone here, we have around 20 minutes for Q&A. Please raise your hand if you would like to ask a question. Also, those of you who are joining us online, we will have the opportunity for you to ask questions as well. So please, over here, the gentleman over here in the blue shirt, number one.
Exactly. I know I'm getting a chocolate. So that is what was my question. In fact, in this choice between the chocolate lottery and the Bashan share, at what point are we making the decision, before or after the names have been assigned to numbers? I mean, you know, something ritualistic about this conversation. So it seems to me that if it's after those names have been applied, then it's just not true that everybody had, you know, this 9.9 XND welfare. It was already the case that one of them had no chance of getting the well-being, so the Pareto principle can apply in that case. Right. And then if it's before the cards have been assigned, then we could say, well, it's not clear that 100, the person 100 is the one who's... Well, I mean, it depends on whether if you've already decided on a policy which 100, irrespective of who's been assigned. Anyway, so it seems to me it matters very much whether the assignment is before or after the decision in this case.
Yeah, totally agree. So let's focus on the case where I've already done the assignment, right? So it's already fixed who is person 100. You know, I can point at the card and say it's the person whose name is on that card. So you said in that case, the ex ante, that person's chance, it's not the case that for everybody in this room, picked out by their names even, they have a chance of 0.99 of getting a chocolate, right? And I think that would be true if, when we're calculating ex ante prospects or expected welfare, we were using objective probabilities. But I don't think we usually are, because we don't know what the objective probabilities are. So usually when you're the decision maker, you're using ex ante, you're using expected welfare, calculated using your own credences or subjective probabilities and not the objective ones. So my criticism does depend on the idea that we're using expected welfare calculated using your credences, not objective chances. So if we switch to a case where we haven't yet done the distribution, like it's still, the random process hasn't taken place yet, then I think that's a really tricky case, right? Because at that point, it's not clear whether or not we can designate the person who will be number 100. I think we can if we're committed to running the lottery, but in some cases we might, if we decide not to run it, then there may be no, and it's a genuinely indeterministic process, there will be no person who is the person who will be number 100. I find those cases really puzzling, yeah. As you know, in fact, yeah.
Good, other questions? Yes, there in the middle, the lady, yeah.
Hi, thank you very much. I work in the field of public policy and law, and I would like to know, I mean, if you have recent example of like the credence concept apply in public policy and especially in health. Because I mean, recently, for example, I mean, I work like in West Africa most of the time, and then it's pretty difficult like to basically involve people and involve local community around family planification, because for them, family planification lead to abortion. And in certain community, I mean, it's still like a difficult concept to grasp. So I'm particularly really interested in like the credence concept. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you. So if I've understood the question right, one of the thoughts is that we're involving the population themselves in the decision, right? So we could have done that here. We could have all taken a vote on whether we wanted chocolate lottery or bash and share. And if we'd done that, and everyone had voted based on their own calculation of their expected welfare, we would have gone for chocolate lottery. Every single person would have voted for it. And I think effectively what's happening there is poor old person 100, there's nobody here to speak for them because nobody knows that they are person 100. And so that would be a move to going for people's own subjective probabilities, their own credences making the decision, their own credences being the thing that does the deciding. But I don't think that's always right. Like often a policymaker or a doctor or whoever's making the decision has more information than the people before them and can make decisions on behalf of people who can't speak for themselves. And I kind of think that's what's happening in this case, right? Person 100, you don't know who you are, but I think we should still take your welfare into account.
Thanks, thanks, Anna. So in the chocolate case, it seems, okay, so it seems to me like you should still just run the chocolate lottery, even though it's not ex ante Pareto optimum. I wonder if we can say there that the reason that you should do that is because there is some set of designators under which it's ex ante Pareto optimal. And that's, so that's just like a sort of stronger version of the ex ante Pareto principle. I imagine that's going to run me into other problems, but what are those other problems?
Actually, if I can remember right, your ethical views, you might not perceive them as problems, because I think it leads, that move leads directly to utilitarianism, because yeah, because if we've got under some policy, we might have goods distributed unevenly, but if we can come up with designators where we don't know which person is assigned to which designator, so if we just sort of randomize like I did with the cards, but then we don't know which person is which, and I just designate them like that, then every person's expected welfare is going to be the same. So under these sort of random designators, everyone's going to have the same expected welfare. And so we just take the total welfare and divide it by the number of people. And in chocolate lottery, of course, there was greater total welfare than there is in bash and share. When I bash that chocolate up, I am making the pie smaller, effectively. There's less to share out between us because I've taken away the niceness and made it more horrible. So I talk about the approach you're mentioning. I call it subvaluationism, where any set of designators is enough. If it's ex ante pareto superior under any set of designators, it's ex ante pareto superior, full stop. But yeah, it leads directly to utilitarianism, which is, you might think it's fine. It's certainly a surprising result, right?
We have questions from some people online.
Yes, thanks very much, Anna. Yes, I'm here with the online questions. So people who are joining us through the LSE Live platform can ask questions online. We have quite a few of them, so I won't be able to get to them all here, but I can start with this one. How do you see these ideas tying in with climate justice? What impact might designators have in this context?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes, so I'm trying to think about action. I think it's already the case, right, that there is no action we can take in this context which is ex ante pareto superior that's going to be better for everybody. If, for example, we divert some of the funds from the people who are helping create climate change to the people who are suffering for it, from it, even though I totally think that's the right thing to do, I don't think it's the right thing to do because it's Pareto superior, right? It's going to be worse for the people who are creating the climate change. So I don't think that the ex ante Pareto principle applies there. Maybe it would if we went for the subvaluationist view, because utilitarianism would lead us to take a lot more action on climate change than I think we are doing.
Do you want to take one more question online?
Yeah, happy to do that. What are the similarities between this designator's picture and Rawls's veil of ignorance? Could the veil of ignorance be seen as a way of expressing a preference for a certain kind of designator?
Yeah, I think there's a way of designating every member of the population such that we don't know anything about, or our views about them are just evenly spread across them. So if you've got, say, five people, and some of them are rich, and some of them are poor, and some of them are old, and some of them are young, but then you just call them person 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and you've randomly assigned those designators, and you don't know who is who, then your expectation that they have any of those features is going to be evenly distributed. For person number one, your expectation of their age is just going to be the average of the ages across the people, and so on. So I think that we can use these sort of randomizing designators to understand what's happening with Rawlsians. Veil of ignorance, and in a way, that's why we arrive at utilitarianism. Yeah, it's sort of like a shortcut to that, because of course the question you want to ask with Rawls's veil of ignorance is, why should we go behind the veil? But the answer to that can just be, well, it's one of the ways of designating people, and if any way of designating people gives us, if under any way of designating people, a particular choice is ex ante pareto superior, then that's enough, right? And this is one of the ways of designating them.
I'm going to exercise chair's privilege and ask you to see if we can get your principle applied to some policy questions, which relates also to the question you asked. So one very standard approach, not uncontroversial, in economics is cost-benefit analysis. Mm-hmm. And it's applied to lots of different types of risk regulations. So take an example. Suppose that it costs £500 per person in the UK to reduce the amount of mercury in the drinking water. And we also know that this will reduce each person's chance of severe medical complications as a consequence of overdose of mercury by only 1 in 100,000. So then one way that cost-benefit analysis asks us, should we implement this policy, is take each person in the population, say, are you willing to pay £500 more to reduce your chance of dying or severe illness due to mercury poisoning in your water by 1 in 100,000? Now, that framework seems to employ a version of the ex-ante Pareto principle that you just articulated. What's wrong with it? It sounds quite appealing. That's how I would think of voting on, say, my water bills going up by £500 or not.
Yeah. So if we want to, we can think about another way of designating all the members of a population, right? So, I mean, suppose it was the case, I don't know whether this is the case, that some people are particularly susceptible to mercury poisoning and some people aren't. So if we take the person in the UK who is most susceptible to mercury poisoning, if we take that as our designator, a way of designating a particular person, then the expected welfare for that person under deciding not to correct for mercury in the water is going to be really bad. So it's not ex ante Pareto superior if that is one of our ways of picking people out. And I don't see why it shouldn't be, right? I feel like the ways that we pick people out currently, it's just what seems obvious to us and what seems obvious to policymakers. But there's no rationale behind it. So either we should look at all the ways of designating people, or we should recognise that when we're choosing how to designate them, we're making an ethical decision. And I don't see why we should make it in terms of calling people by name or national insurance number, rather than by where they stand in the order of susceptibility to mercury poisoning.
Thank you. We have time for one final question. Yes, the gentleman in the blue shirt here.
Okay. So it seems to me as if there's a kind of enabling assumption to all of this. These questions are all opaque if we assume that there is kind of a cost-benefit to wage here. You pointed out early on that if there's like a free lunch on the table, then we don't have that kind of a problem. What have we done to rule out the fact that we're not in the situation of a free lunch? You know, like in the case of climate change, maybe it's just a free lunch. It just makes everyone's life better if we tackle it. And we don't have to have these discussions, and we don't have this problem about trying to find the designation. Do we have easy ways of figuring out when we're in those situations? Have we maybe assumed too much when we assume that we are in a situation where we have to have these trade-offs?
I guess a situation where we think there's a free lunch is a situation where a particular policy is better for everyone, right? And I guess my main point is just that if you think you've got a free lunch situation, just check, because it might be that you're designating everyone in one way and that looks like a free lunch situation. Designate them differently and it isn't a free lunch situation anymore. So one way we could go, in fact, my preferred way to go for interpreting the Pareto principle given this problem is, right, I call it supervaluationism. So the idea is that you have to consider all the designators, like all the ways of designating the population. And there are some policies which are going to be a proper free lunch, right? They're going to be better for everyone under every way of designating the whole population. They're the genuine free lunches, and I think they do exist. So, I mean, suppose I had 100 chocolates, right? So everybody could get one, or I could bash them all up and cut them into 100 again. There's no way of designating you all where anybody gets a better outcome under bash and share, if that's the situation. So I think there are sometimes free lunches, but I just think that I really like your expression, by the way. It makes it easier for me to express this, yeah. But I just think that lots of policies have been perceived to be a free lunch, but actually there's somebody and a way of designating them who is losing out as a result of this. And we should consider the expected welfare for that person under that designator too.
Please join me in thanking Anna Matani for a wonderful
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.